Hey everyone, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome to our Neuro Innovation Talks podcast. This is a unique effort we're doing in partnership with Johnson & Johnson MedTech Neurovascular. Well, we'll be talking to leaders in their neuro space, and we're starting with a very unique population, the surgeon leaders. So very happy to be joined by the host of this podcast series, John Murray. John is head of global strategic marketing and strategic relationships at Johnson & Johnson MedTech Neurovascular. John, you came to us with this idea for a podcast. I'd love to hear what the inspiration was from your end.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me. And I'm very pleased to share with you my idea. And I really appreciate the partnership. I think there's a lot of opportunity for us to share what I think is some very interesting information.
We love people who love podcasts, John. So yeah, we're looking forward to it as well.
Yeah, I'm so impressed with the work that you've done and the reach that you have. And honestly, I've been thinking about creating this podcast for a few years now, and partly because I've been very fortunate to be part of this neurovascular field since the mid '90s, and I've seen so much growth and the evolution of what's possible in neurovascular disease. And in part, it's because of a select group of visionaries that really have made a significant impact. And personally, it's been a highlight of my professional career to interact with these individuals and in some cases, become friends with these pioneers. And I really feel like I'm in a unique position in my role at J&J MedTech to memorialize these really extraordinary contributions of these early innovators, especially as we see many physicians entering the specialty today. Mm-hmm. And you know, with the many physicians that I've spoken to over the course of my career, I realized that the younger generations know about the contribution of these visionaries and mavericks, but they don't really know the people. Mm-hmm. They didn't know their stories, you know, what drove them, what kept inspiring them in those early days when ultimately they developed this field. So for me, my hope for this podcast is really a couple of things. I really want to create a platform here to share the stories of these groundbreaking mavericks in their words. I wanted to capture what motivated them and also the approach that they had to their work, their mentorship, and the impact that they've had on patients and families. And then finally, this is my ultimate goal. I want to cement the important legacy of these pioneers so that physicians that are entering the field today, they know about the origin of this work. It's just too important not to share.
Just sitting in on some of these talks, I was really taken aback by the adventurous spirit that sort of went on in early innovation and the courage that a lot of these folks show in trying to find the best treatment for patients. What are some of the things that you hope people take away from listening to this podcast?
You know, I hope that listeners, whether they're physicians, engineers, medical students, or even patients, will be motivated by these conversations and become inspired to innovate themselves and continue to help address the unmet needs in neurovascular care. Because I know personally, for me, the collaboration that we've had at J&J MedTech Neurovascular with these early innovators have pushed us and inspired us to continue to invest and to develop to support these patients. And, you know, the relationships, it's always complicated, but they're intertwined. And that's what makes the connection between industry and clinicians so important. And it's one of the reasons I think I'm able to do this podcast today is because I've been privileged to work closely with this group of physicians. And I have a sense of gratitude professionally that they've opened up their stories. They've been vulnerable. And they've shared the way that they approach things like mentorship. And so I'm very lucky and fortunate to have been part of this podcast series, and I look forward to it.
That's great. That's always the best part of a conversation, when you know you're seeing inside the person and you're understanding the decisions they had to make and the reasons they made those decisions. I think those are moments in life that cement that kind of cement our relationships with others. We can all connect with that moment where you're wondering whether to turn left or right or do this or that. So I'm excited to hear the entire series. But our first guest, your first interview, is with Dr. Alejandro Bernstein. He is the professor of neurosurgery, pediatrics, and radiology, and he's also the director of pediatric cerebrovascular surgery at Mount Sinai Health System. So, without giving away too many details, what are some of the takeaways?
We were very thoughtful, as you know, about which physicians we wanted to feature in this podcast. And those were the people who very early on helped to define the field, who expanded the boundaries of what was possible in neurovascular, and who created trailblazing innovations. And with that background, today's discussion is with Dr. Alejandro Bernstein. Now, as a side note, Tom, this was the first lab that I visited when I entered this space in the mid-1990s. Now, we covered a lot during our time together, certainly focusing on his groundbreaking advances in treating vena galen and facial malformations, and of course, his amazing pediatric work. I was really interested to hear his insights in how he stayed motivated and inspired during those early years, especially when the outcomes weren't always what he had hoped for. I think listeners will also be very interested to learn about Dr. Bernstein's unique approach to leadership, how he always centers the humanity of his patients, and of course, how he still brings so much energy and passion to his work today.
Before we begin this episode, I'd like to bring in a conversation our managing editor, Kayleen Brown, had with our sponsor, Zeus.
Kyle Crabb, Global Account Manager for Zeus. Welcome to the Neuro Innovation Podcast. We're so excited to have you here today.
I'm excited as well. Thanks for having me.
So, Kyle, let's start at the beginning. Can you tell us about Zeus?
Yes, we are a world leader in polymer extrusion. Basically, anything from drawings that you have on napkins to full-blown production, we're meeting you every step of the way in your med device journey as you go to, basically, in the end, saving people's lives. It's a really cool company, really fun company to work with, and we look forward to working with any and all customers out there, from contract manufacturers to startups. Again, like I said, from prototypes to production, this is what we do all day long.
Terrific. So I have to know, Kyle, how long have you been with Zeus?
On and off for 20 years. I live here in Orangeburg. I started off as a technical account manager covering everything west of the Mississippi. It's really cool to see the growth that we've had there. You know, whenever I was handling it, there was one person and there's probably 10 people handling it now. So that growth is monumental, really, here for small town South Carolina. To see it grow to China, to Europe, to MIA, APAC, it's really cool.
So Zeus clearly has so many capabilities and a global reach. So how do customers typically engage with Zeus?
Yeah, the best way for customers is to contact your field support team. We're meeting you in your area, in your neck of the woods. So we have technical resources there from our FAE teams to our technical account managers on the inside of Zeus to our technical field sales folks as well. So multiple folks. We can bring in engineers from the home offices to help with your designs, whether it's sizing issues, heat shrink issues. We'll bring engineers to meet you, which I think is a great and free service that a lot of companies don't offer. So it's really cool. You can go old school. You can call. You can email. You can go through the website. We're out there. All we need you to do is call.
Excellent. And for those who are listening and like to engage with Zeus, you can go to zeusinc.com. That's ZEUSINC.com.
All right. It was great to hear from Zeus. Now let's begin our interview with Dr. Alejandro Bernstein.
Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Bernstein.
Thank you.
Very, very excited to have you here. And before we begin, I just want to go back in time a bit to the mid-90s when I first joined the neurovascular world, and the first lab that I visited was your lab. And I want to thank you for being so gracious to open up your doors and allow me to spend time with you and the fellows to really learn. I think back on those days, when I was sitting in the NGO suite, I opened up my Ann Osborne Cerebral Angiography textbook and would open up to the page where you were doing a super selective angiography run prior to a brain AVM. Here we are nearly 30 years later, and I'm still as energized as I was in those days and really happy to be here with you, someone who I consider a pioneer in the neurovascular field. And when I think about that, a question for you. When you look back on your career, this field did not really exist at that time when you first started as a physician. What drove you to commit your energy, your enthusiasm, your creativity to addressing these unmet needs in neurovascular disease? And was there ever an aha moment in those early days?
Well, you know, I have to go back to the time when I finished medical school in Mexico. We are supposed to do a thing called social service. In Mexico, we paid at the time the equivalent of $16 for medical school. And the deal is that the government, the country is investing in you, you have to pay back somehow. Mexico being a country that is still mostly in the 1970s, late 60s, is a country that was quite behind. There were not enough physicians to really take care of the population. So what the government did is it would take people like myself at the end of the medical school. You had to do a pre-grade internship. That means you had to take care in patients under supervision. And then you had to do the social service. So two things happened. When I went to do the social service, I realized that there was tremendous lack of knowledge into things. In addition to that, when I was in Israel doing my internship, I looked at the most incredible thing is you were driving in a road, and on the right side you had desert, and on the left side there was this orange trees. And how did they do it? They do it by a thing called drop-by-drop irrigation. They have no water. And not only that, but it was at a higher level. So they had to bring the water. And the way they did it is with little hoses, with little holes. And they actually did drop-by-drop irrigation. So that stayed in my mind. I finished my internship. I came to the United States to my training. When you come from a place like Mexico to the United States, everything is supposed to be fantastic. Everything is supposed to be better. That's not necessarily so. As a foreign medical graduate, I didn't get the best places. I got wherever they couldn't get Americans. So, you know, I goes the Mexican. So that was in a little hospital in Hartford, Connecticut. There was one individual that played a tremendous influence in my life, Dr. Harold Moskowitz. He was a radiologist. I wanted to be a surgeon. I wanted to be a radiologist. But my wife said, if you're going to be a surgeon the way you work, I'm going back to Canada. So I look at this radiologist. He was doing something I had never seen before. He's putting a catheter into the renal artery, injecting contrast material, and get an angiogram. And I said, bingo. If I take the catheter, put it in the artery, put the chloramphenicol into the renal artery itself, and then take another catheter in the renal vein and take out the medicine, it will never become systemic. And I said, this is the way to treat. I go back to my wife. I said, don't worry, I'm going to become a radiologist. Now, in those days, interventional radiology did not exist. But that was a major part in my life that made me go into this field.
Back in those early days when you were exploring and learning, I'm sure you were facing challenges. Who did you call to get some guidance and support and some feedback? You know, who were the mentors that played a pivotal role in your career and helped you accomplish what you have to date?
Well, as I said, Harold Moskowitz definitely was one, because I was actually a surgical intern at that little hospital. But every moment I had free, I would go to radiology, I would go to the angio to learn how to do an angiogram. And then when I started my residency at Mount Sinai in New York in radiology, I wanted to just do angiography. I didn't care about ultrasound, nuclear medicine, which I always call unclear medicine. I wanted to do angiography. And indeed, they gave me the whole third year. You know, nobody wanted to do it, and I was the only one. So, you know, I did it by default. And there was a great man called Harold Mitty. Harold Mitty was a superb angiographer, and he was definitely a mentor to me. And actually, my first embolization was done with a patient that was bleeding from, had a resection of the stomach, and the left gastric artery was bleeding. I doing the angiogram, and I see the contrast extravasating. So I went to Dr. Mitty, and I said, Dr. Mitty, I have the catheter there. I can stop it. He looked at me like, what are you talking about? And I said, I can stop it. He says, okay. So I took clot from the patient, let it clot, put it, stopped the bleeding for about 5 minutes, and then boom, started on bleeding again. So then I had heard that some of the French people were doing little gel foam, and I went to the OR, took a little piece of gel foam. Actually, the first one, I plucked the catheter. I had to take everything out and go from the other groin. Was able to get into the left gastric artery, put a plug of gel foam, and stop the bleeding. And I said, man, this is it. This is the way to treat. So that he was a major person in my life.
And in those days, I'm sure that you had a lot of pressure, fear, the stakes were high. You were trying new things. You had failures, especially in those very early years. Some of your ideas didn't work, right? How did you approach dealing with that pressure and the emotion that you may have had to deal with in those difficult situations? How did you manage that personally?
Well, you know, how did I? Look, nothing is perfect. When somebody tells you, is everything good? Is the most stupid statement I've ever, it's impossible. So, you know, when you're young and you are starting in your career and you're full of adrenaline or testosterone or whatever you want to do, you are ready to try and don't, you know, if you are a quitter, you're not gonna break ground. So there was really no place to read. You really learn as you're going, because there was nothing to refer to. I remember even buying plastic, tubing, because there were no catheters. And industry did not want to do things for us. They were very worried about the exposure. We learned how to actually manufacture catheters out of tubing, how to flare it, how to make the lower lock area. I would spend 3 days a week building the catheters and 2 days a week doing the procedure. And a procedure in those days would take 7, 8, 10 hours. You know, it was long procedures. So you had to have the stamina, I guess. And it was so fascinating that, I mean, I'm glad that they didn't have Ritalin when I was a kid. They would have given it to me. You know, somehow my parents, my mother was fantastic how she put up with me. And I had my nanny that was amazing. But I think it is the finding out when suddenly you stop the bleeding of somebody who's dying. I mean, there's nothing that can, in my opinion, there's nothing that can match such an emotion, such a feeling, such a situation, and that gives you the energy to not give up.
I'm going to take a moment to go back to a comment you made about growing up and your mother and your nanny. Talk about your childhood and your busyness and your energy, because we're going to cover it later in the interview. You have a lot of energy for sure. And love to hear your perspective on that.
Well, I'm one of those very fortunate persons that I was born in Mexico City. My parents come from Poland, you know, Polish Jews. I'm super lucky that I fully absorb and understand not only the language, but the culture of Mexico and the multiple. One of my hobbies is ancient, cultures of America, of Mexico specifically. So I was able to get into the culture, the flavor, the music, the food, and the same thing with the Jewish thing. And now I'm in the United States. So I've been very lucky to be, influenced by all these different cultures that I think is the day that we have all people mixed with each other. I think we finished with the wars.
Now, I'm going to go back to your comment around developing your own catheters and obviously being innovative. There's many things, Dr. Berenstein, that tie back to you from an innovation point of view. And we'll talk about some of those. But let's start with one thing that I mentioned at the start of the call, your surgical neuroangiography textbook series with Pierre Lajeunesse and Carl Teberg, which obviously looks at the anatomical basis of neurosurgery and neurovascular and understanding the anatomy, which certainly is the basis of your training and how you educated your fellows. But there were a lot of new concepts coming at the time. And we are very aware that many neurosurgeons, radiologists, neurologists all have looked very diligently at these texts as a guide along their careers. I wonder if you could share a little bit about how that book came together and the impact that you think it's had on our field.
I would say that the primary credit goes to Pierre, which had a tremendous drive. You know, Pierre is the one that really pushed for these books to occur. To give you a brief analysis of how it came about, when I started, again, there was no knowledge about the vascular anatomy of the cranial nerves. I had a patient with a glomus tumor that I embolized the ascending pharyngeal in those days with a liquid silicone. Now, I have to tell you, there was no FDA like today. I was able to go get crazy glue from the hardware store and play with it. And, you know, if I had a patient with a dying condition, I could use it. So this is a silicone. In any event, I injected and got the whole tumor completely filled with a liquid embolic. And the patient developed a 9, 10, and 11 cranial nerve. That was very surprised and upset. I went to Wiesbaden, Germany, and there was this symposium neuroradiological, and the French were ahead of us in interventional. And Pierre Lajeunesse presented a paper of the ascending pharyngeal arteries, the artery supplies, the 9, 10, 11, and 12 cranial nerves. You know, I was just a fellow, and I tried to approach him. He was my same age. He was also a young starter, but, you know, the French were the French, and they were just, you know. So I decided, don't talk to him in English. I came and I'd say, perdone, ¿habla usted español? So you take a French guy and talk to him in Spanish. Oh, they listen. You know, it's not English, you know. So, okay, so now they listen to me. So I'm talking, and he says, no, he said, I don't speak Spanish. I said, do you speak English? So he said, yes, okay. So then I said, you're right. Now, whenever you see somebody and you tell him you're right, they'll always listen to you. You know, you're right. I like to hear that I'm right. So I told him what I had a patient that confirms his description of the anatomy. So he invited me to France, to Paris, to spend time with him. And I went and I spent time with him, and I told him things I could do. You know, I could use balloons, reverse the flow. And the guy looks at me, he says, impossible, impossible. I said, come to New York and I'll show you. So he came to New York, and I remember clearly the patient with a vascular malformation of the lip, the upper lip. And then I said to him, when he showed me the internal maxillary and the facial, I said, if you're right, I can go ahead. I can go beyond the lip, put something, close the artery. Then I can put glue to the lip and nothing will happen. He looked at me. He realized that I was right. I was using his anatomy. And I did that. He looks at it. It was fantastic. And that was the spring. I confirmed to Pierre how we use this anatomy. So we wrote the first two papers. The first paper was normal functional anatomy of the facial artery. And the second paper, where he was the first author, and the second paper where I was the first author, was functional anatomy in pathological conditions. How do you use this anatomy? And that, out of there came all the books and the anatomy. Now, the facial artery was the most simple artery. Then came the base of the skull, the anastomosis with the eye to prevent blindness, the anastomosis with the brain to prevent stroke. So we knew that we had something that was unique. And that's how we put together, and that created the first set of volumes. And then Pierre was again right. He said, let's separate them and make a book on anatomy only, and then a book on functional embolization, and then a book on technology. He says, because technology will change, but the anatomy and how you use it will never change. So that was the first edition.
Fantastic. And thank you for that background. I didn't know all that history. I didn't know how it all came together. And I think a lot of our listeners, especially the younger physicians, are utilizing that series of books to help them as they build their careers. Something often that comes up about you when I talk to others is your pioneering of certain techniques. In particular, I'm talking about your pediatric work, Vena Galen, your facial malformations, and eventually working to expand the group of physicians that can use them. I don't want to say mainstream, but certainly procedures now today that are adopted and well known. Was any of this a conscious decision by you to make this a mainstream procedure, or was this something that was more based on necessity? These are very complicated and risky procedures with babies. And I'm curious to know if there was anything specific that motivated you to dive into this particular area of medicine within neurovascular.
Yeah. When we started, of course, we did everything. I'll never forget the first patient that died on me. It was a young woman. She was a mother of two children, was in her 30s, had a small AVM on the right hemisphere. A great mentor to me at the time was Dr. Joseph Ransohoff, the chairman of neurosurgery at NYU. He trusted me completely. I was his only adopted child. He had tremendous people he trained all over the world, but I was the only non-neurosurgeon that he adopted. And he gave me the position of, at the time, assistant professor of neurosurgery to permit me admit, so I could admit patients and so on. But to stay on your question, Dorothy, I closed the whole AVM. I was fabulous. Ransoff came in. It was at Bellevue Hospital. Dr. Ransoff comes in. He's so happy. He sees what happens, gives me a hug, and the lady ruptured the AVM and bled and died. Probably I got the vein and didn't close the whole AVM, and I was destroyed. So I said to myself, this works, but I have to choose the right person. So guess what? The next patient was a newborn baby with a vena galen that died from the disease. So I said to myself, this is where you're going to learn. This is the type of patients that need, unless there's nobody that can do anything. Dorothy could have had surgery. She would have been fine. I cannot justify myself to do these procedures in patients like that. So that's when I looked into the vena galen malformations. And they were very challenging. I remember Dr. Chuck Gerber, who he was in Pittsburgh at the time and was trying. He's the one who invented the calibrated leak and the glue. He's the one who introduced the glue to our field. So we brought Dr. Gerber to New York. He and I worked for 11 hours to try to catheterize a little baby with a vena galen. We go and we close one feeder. But it was the beginning. It was obvious that this was the patients that if we can mature the technique, then later on we'll apply it to what we call now the conventional. So that was the AVM justification to start with that. Obviously, vena galen were rare. And then I started getting them from all over because nobody wanted to do them. So actually that's how those things happened. With the maxillofacials, I also had a similar story. I didn't have a complication, but I had patients with the facial AVM would come in with all type of ligations, because the plastic surgeon didn't know what to do. So they closed the carotid because they were bleeding, things like that. And I had this young man who has so many ulcers and he exsanguinated. So I said, that's another disease that we have to. But at that time, I was not aware that all the ligations or proximal closures are what made the disease bad. That later on became, very important to see how you treat them to get. We didn't know so much about nidus and vein. We didn't know those things at the time. But it became apparent that we had to approach it differently. So that's when, and again, a rare disease, again, a disease that nobody wanted, so they dumped it on me, which was okay, because that gives me, but it's not only myself. You have to create a team. You're as good as the people that surround you. And I'm talking not only the doctors, but the technologists, the nurses, the intensive care, the pediatricians. Because they were rare diseases, we created teams. And I remember picking up a hematologist, Francine Bly. You know, she was the fellow in hematology. The hematologist didn't, my patients were so complicated. Okay, Francine, you can make a career. She's now the world number one person in vascular lesions in the world. So the idea is that it's not, you cannot do anything one person. It has to be a team.
Yeah, that's great perspective. And you mentioned that difficult complication. I mean, it's just amazing to me how vivid it is still for you today and even the patient's name.
All right, we'll take a quick break from this interview to bring back a message from our sponsor, Zeus.
So, Kyle, I know that I have been seeing Zeus everywhere in the news, some exciting developments. Do you have any news that you can share with us?
Yeah, we'll take the curtain back a little bit for you guys. Earlier this year, we were purchased by EQT. They brought on new leadership, tons of investment, as well as reorganized our supply chain, which I think was critical, especially as we came out of the crisis from the pandemic. So all great things. We just broke ground on a brand new R&D facility in Aston, South Carolina, which is going to house all of our R&D work, which is going to be great for customers just starting out new projects. Speed to market is critical. Zeus leadership understands this, and there's been a huge commitment to this. Secondly, for our MIA and APAC customers, we're doubling the production size of our facility in Ireland, which is tremendous, especially given the growth in those two areas around the country and around the globe. So, you know, EQT is, they're all in. We've even, you know, purchased Cathex to help out with the integrated supply chain, you know, going up and down vertically. So we're there for you. All we need to do is make a little contact and know that we've got a solution for you.
First, huge congratulations. This is really exciting. Take us home here. What trends are you seeing based on your customers' needs?
Yes, going smaller is by far the neurovascular way, right? But in doing so, you still need real estate. And what Zeus does is better than anyone else in the world is tight tolerances on thin wall material. So take, for instance, our Streamliner series, which is less than one thou of an inch. We're now having better concentricity actually extruding over wire. So you're going to get better real estate with a thinner wall. And I believe that this is going to be the trend moving forward. It's going to give you strength, flexibility, everything that you need to get to the tortuous pathways inside the brain. I think another trend that you'll probably see and something that folks should be working with is our floor peels, our peelable heat shrink. This is great for small microcatheters. It's easy to work with, and it's going to save you a lot during your process, whether it's safety issues by not bringing in razor blades to the facility. Is also, you can have some yield improvements because you're not nicking devices and tearing down what you've tried so hard to build up. So floor peels is another thing that you're going to see for the continuation of the neurovascular advancements.
Excellent. Well, Kyle, it was such a pleasure having you on the podcast. Again, for our audience, if you want to learn more about Zeus and how you can engage with Zeus, go to zeusinc.com, ZEUSINC.com. Kyle Krapp, Global Account Manager with Zeus, thank you very much for joining us today.
Absolutely. And if you want to go old school, call the 1-800 number, ask for me, I'll get you in the right direction.
Excellent. Thanks again.
Now, well, is the conclusion of our interview with Dr. Alejandro Bernstein.
In those early years, Dr. Bernstein, when those surgical outcomes were poor and you had terrible complications, and especially in the pediatric patients, I know that must have been very difficult for you to bear at the time. What kept you going and motivated to keep trying different approaches, knowing that this was going to be risky and complex?
Well, you know, fortunately, the majority of patients did well. I remember very well my complications. I don't remember so good my successes, but we had so many more successes than complications. We were very complication allergic, you know. That's part of my problem with some of the other people at the time. You know, some other people were more cowboys. I was very cautious about it. So the complication rate was, unfortunately, very serious. When I had a problem, it was not like a, you know, a little nose guy. You know, when I had a problem, it was a disaster. Okay, but it was very low. The complication rate was very, very low. Then we learned how to select patients. As we got better, as we developed techniques. For example, for me in the vena galens, let's say 8-10 years after starting doing them, was not to close the brain, it's how to get into their body and not lose the femoral artery. So that's when I developed the umbilical artery. It became an obvious place. They're gonna, because you have to be curious. These newborn babies, we had to really figure out when best to treat them. At the beginning, we only treat the ones that didn't respond to medical treatment. Now I know none of them respond to medical. So now we don't wait till they're so sick to get them for EMBO. We just don't wait. We know how parameters of the reversal of flow, we bring them. The healthier the kid, the better he's going to do, the newborn. But that's what developed, but it made us develop techniques like the umbilical approach. And then suddenly now today you can see that almost every newborn that gets any kind of AVM or any, now the umbilical is a, as you call it, routine, is, is done many places. But that's how, an example of one of the things that we had to develop as we go. So the answer to your question is because we had such a good result, like a shock absorber, it absorbed. But let me tell you, one of the things that I learned from Grant Haishima, for example, is that when you have a complication like the ones we have, is we tend to not talk about it. We tend to be quiet. What we do now is if we have such a complication, we will get, the team gets together and we can cry. Crying is okay. You've done, you just, somebody died on your hands. It's actually health. I can sound crying now, but I don't want to. But let me tell you, the moment that you become callous, you become a dangerous person. So it was very important to deal with the emotion. Maybe not in the immediate moment when it happened, and then take another session and review what happened. Why? See how you can avoid it from happening again. That's how you have to deal with this.
Fantastic advice, in particular for our younger listeners, those that are having some challenges in the early part, and even those that are most experienced. This is a theme that I see with those that are pioneers in this space, is learning from the failures, looking them in the eye and taking that positive out of it about what you learned. And to your point, you've taken a nice approach of look at all the successes that we've had. You mentioned the babies. I've told you this story, and you and your wife, Josie, when I see you at meetings, sometimes I'd be in the hospital. It would be a little bit crazy. Something would go wrong. The machine would go down, and you'd elevate your voice a bit and get everybody in order. And then all of a sudden, the stretcher would come rolling through with the baby and mom and dad, and you would just, in my eyes, transform into that supportive, reassuring physician to make that family feel better and confident. How do you go through that? How do you transform like that?
It's your duty. I mean, many times when I would raise my voice in a situation like that, I wasn't really mad. But I needed my team to understand that I'm sorry is not acceptable. If somebody would tell me, break something and say, I'm sorry, I said, no. If we kill somebody, what are we going to say to the parents? I'm sorry? So I'm sorry does not exist. I need you, my team, be even above me. You have to be completely concentrated, completely in control. And then when the family comes in, can you imagine you have a baby, a newborn, a child, and the baby, the child has a brain problem or a face deformity. How, the brain is such a mystic organ. I mean, when your kid is sick, that's bad enough when they have a fever. But now somebody tells you he's got a brain problem. You're in shock. So you need to give that family the feeling that you are competent to take care of that problem, because they're looking at you because they have nowhere else to look.
Exactly.
If you become pompous and you become arrogant and you become condescending, it's not my style. I mean, it's actually, I think, the most counterproductive thing that you can do. You need to show empathy, show that you realize there's a big problem. At the same time, you don't offer You don't tell the family, oh, don't worry, everything is going to be okay. You can't say, because not everything is going to be okay all the time. So you need to have the confidence that you can help the child in a very serious situation. So that's your role. That's your job.
Yeah. I'm going to dive a little bit into a personal realm here just for a moment. And this is a personal experience as well. When I think of you, I always hear your voice saying things like, walk with me. I might have something new to talk to you about. And I'd get 5 minutes and we would walk and talk is always the term. We also had one of the mentees that we interviewed said, Dr. Berenstein is someone that if there was a cab pulling away, you'd be the guy running after it, not waiting for the next cab. Someone also said that you're never looking in the rearview mirror or stuck in the past. You're always looking forward. What's next? First, do you agree with this assessment that you're always driving forward? And what shaped this philosophy for you? Does this come from when you grew up? Is this something else in your past?
Well, again, you are the way you are. There's certain things you can't change. I would just like to say that I always look in the rear mirror to see if nothing is coming behind. I also look in the rear mirror when something went wrong to avoid it, trying to avoid repeating it. But yes, you look forward. My wife said that the way my mind works, my brain works, is if I would be a fisherman, I would have a little rod in it all around the boat, not just one. I guess that's my nature, and that is that it's imperative, it's necessary to not waste time. When I interview the fellows, mostly in my younger years, it was the best place to interview them was going up and down the stairs at Bellevue. Why? Because if I had no patience to wait for the elevators. NYU was even worse. So we had patients on the 11th floor. We were in the second floor. So, and besides, it's good exercise. So if the fellow could not follow me up and down the stairs, he couldn't be my fellow. So that was a very easy thing to do. With you, with industry, I realized that also your time is precious. So I didn't want to be cocky, but at the same token, I didn't have all the time in the world to sit down. And so, okay, walk and talk. If you really need to have too much a conversation, I'm not interested. What is the problem? So the walk and talk means cut the baloney and let's go to the subject.
You mentioned at the start, you've been at this for a while, and it seems to me and many around you that you've got the same amount of energy today than you did when you first started in Hartford, for example. How do you do it, and what's next? How do you keep that energy up, and where do you take it from here?
Well, again, there's one thing. I'm short, I'm chubby, I can't change that. The good news is that I have a lot of energy, so I don't want to lose that. I exercise practically every day. I think that has a lot to do with the level. I don't sleep much. So I need 4 or 5 hours sleep. That's all I need. I'm 77 years old and I'm still pumping. So I'm glad. Why or how? I don't know, but it works.
It's a mindset, it seems like. And I'm sure in your career, Dr. Berenstein, there's a lot that you could point to be proud of, especially when you look in that rearview mirror and see the things that you've accomplished. Does anything in particular stand out to you that you're especially proud of?
Again, as you say, maybe some of the things that I done that is definitely the vena galen. These kids used to all die, the spinal cord AVMs. I think the variable stiffness catheter, today people don't realize what we have, the technology that we have. I had, the first variable stiffness catheter is the Berenstein catheter. The tracker catheter was based on that, actually between Johnson & Johnson and Target at the time, there was a big controversy when you came up with the Prolo catheter, if you remember, and they used the Berenstein catheter as a pre-existing thing, and we made peace with everybody. I think that, you know, digital subtraction and geography, the real one was introduced by Charlie Stroder in Masreta, but I had done it before, except that, again, there was my, I guess, my hippie years. You know, we created a engineer that I had in NYU, created the first digital subtraction using an image trapper. And there was a company in New Jersey, and then there was Hughes Aircraft Corporation. So the people from Hughes Aircraft Corporation contact me and said, hey, we would like to develop this with you. And I said, oh, the big company wants to swallow the little company. What a mistake. I sided with the little company in New Jersey, which went broke. And then Philips came up with the other one. So, you know, the ability to, we used to do hand subtraction in those days, but now we could do it electronically. So they've been knock on wood, and tell you there's still things now happening. You know what we're doing now is, you know, with the you know, articulating technology. You know, that's going to transform the entire field. What we're doing is, you know, we're going to get into cancer now. You know, we're going to get into do a project how to do super selective treatment. You know, we're now in the process of doing the IP, but that's kind of, so the good news is that there have been many things, and hopefully there'll be newer, there'll be other things that come up.
You know, I'm going to take out the opportunity to ask you a follow-up question to what you just said, because obviously what you just highlighted here are areas that you believe the market will evolve into and expand into. Is there a burning question in your mind that's still unanswered?
Burning about the future?
Neurovascular disease. And is there something in particular that we still need to solve?
Oh, this the day we there's something we don't have to solve is the end of the world. Yes, there is. But I think that we have such a fantastic access to the human body, to the body, because, I mean, this is going to be able to be used in veterinary medicine too. But we have such a fabulous access. Today, we have become really good in navigating in, let's say, the streets of the cities. And we've navigating in the highways and the freeways. But now we're going to the next is to go through the sewer system. So we are now going to start on evolving in the venous system. And we're going to be able to reach things that we have not reached before, but coming from the venous system to the capillary level, where the real exchange. Remember, the arteries are conduits. The arteries really don't do anything. The veins are drainage. The capillary venular level is where everything is happening. So we're going to reach, that's a next frontier for cancer. For, I think we're going to treat epilepsy. I can figure out several ways that we can go with catheters to first find. We're going to have electrodes. You know, now we're getting into putting electric discharges, both sensors and stimulators. So we're starting to get through this array of arteries, veins, and so on. So we're going to do physiological things, movement disorders, epilepsy. It's only limited by one thing, imagination. That's the only limit.
That's a great point. And with that, obviously, we've had a relationship for many years, and we continue to do work together. What do you see the role of industry in the partnership with clinicians? How do you see that, the value of that?
Oh, I think it's priceless. I think that we are where we are because of this relationship that we have. I think that there has been, no question, some improvements to prevent, you know, financial conflicts. I think the key is disclosure. But I think that we cannot survive without the other. We need each other. So I am very pro industry. I think that it's important, again, to disclose. You know, the problem is when you don't disclose. When, oh, but you didn't tell us that you have stuck in that company you promote. You know, we're all humans. So there's no question that if I invent something, I have an interest in that being successful. So, but I think that the relationship of industry and medicine and science is a must. It's very productive. Look where we've gotten. I mean, look where it is. You know, today the imaging, the 3D, the computerized analysis to which device to deploy, it's quite impressive how accurate they are. Today, we can actually take 3D images and do a three-dimensional, what do you call it, the printer, the 3D printing, and you can make an entire model. So now you can test devices, you can test access, you can teach, not in patients, but so that is even going to expand farther. So we need industry to have a motivation to do better 3D printing, to do better catheters, to do better cyanoacrylates. You know, so I think it's a symbiotic relationship.
Many listeners of this podcast, as I said, will be physicians, engineers, manufacturers, people that are in the medical device field. What advice would you have for the new inventors and the innovators that are coming into our space?
Well, I mean, look, there's a learning curve, as the people, which I hate that word, but there's a learning curve. And I think as a young, creative individual, if you have an idea, the best thing you can do, because you're not a lawyer and you've never done this before, the best you can do is write it down in your own words, put it to make a drawing, things like that. Go with somebody like your teacher, your mentor, another colleague of the same field, and ask them to read it and say, yes, read, understood, and sign, put the date. When you have that, you have a little bit of protection. But I think that, like with you, John, I have had very good relationship with a number of, I mean, Johnny, you were a intern when you came, and you didn't know much about the topic, but you were curious. You know, to me, if somebody's curious, then I pay attention. If a salesperson comes in and tries to tell me what I lose interest in it. But if you start on, you want to know, and I mean, I remember you coming. I also used that book because there were no books in that. So I mean, to see a salesperson coming in with an anatomy book is not frequent, and mostly in those days. The same thing happened with my technicians. My techs, the techs that we had at NYU, at Beth Israel, at Roosevelt, the techs that we have at science, they know how to read the angios. They know they are part of the team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you asked me also for a key moment that made this a real specialty. I have two stories. One is that, you know, in the days when we started, it took a long time, preparation and so on. And then, you know, the surgeon, you're going around trying to push the catheter. And suddenly the neurosurgeon comes in the room because, you know, the neurosurgeons own everything. Okay. So they come in and say, hey, I'm a, and that was, you know, Ransov was the boss, you know, so here I am. I didn't want to be interrupted. I needed to concentrate, but the neurosurgeon was very busy and now they have 20 minutes. So they came down to radiology to go over there was no MR in the time, go over the angio, the CT at the time. And, you know, so you had to stop what you're doing to go over. So I said, I need to change this. So one day I took and I put a mask, a hat and a mask. Because in those days in the angio room, you had the sterile towel, but you didn't waste hard mask. You didn't need to. And I'll never forget Professor Ransov coming down as usual, like a storm coming in, and he sees me with a mask and a hat, and he goes, excuse me, may I interrupt? And I said, wow. Yes. Yes. Okay. That's one. And the other one is how you get the team in a radiology environment. When I moved from NYU to Beth Israel, or when I moved I don't remember if it was to Beth Israel or when we moved to Roosevelt, we came in and the technicians, they just wanted, come on, you know, I was a pain, you know, my procedures lasted so long, they used to change me three technicians, so on. So I used to, as you witness, I bring the family, I bring the parents, and show them, after we do the angio, I bring the families and I show them what we find and we go over. And I'll never forget I had this girl, now she was 19 years old. I treated her when she was a newborn. She had a AVM, the whole brainstem, horrible. But I kept her going for 19 years. And it came a point that she was there was no way that I could do anymore. And I brought the mother to the room. And I told the mother that, you know, I showed the pictures. I mean, the lady was very involved. And I said, we have to stop. There's not more, much more. And then suddenly she started crying, and I turned around. All my techs were crying. From that day on, I never had a peal from the technician complaining about time and that, because they became part. We were not doing x-rays anymore. We were taking care of patients. So there was another moment that that was special.
Those are fantastic stories. And I'm going to take this opportunity to say thank you for sharing a lot with our audience and with me. This is a huge gift to all of us. When you talk about your career, the things that you've done, and the impact that this has had on patients and humanity. So thank you for being who you are, and thank you for joining our podcast.
Thank you. And you made me tear a little bit. Thank you, Johnny.
Thank you.
Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Neuro Innovation Talks podcast. Thanks, of course, to our friends at Johnson & Johnson MedTech Neurovascular. It's been great to work with them, in particular with John Murray, who's spearheaded this effort and really helped us tell some important neurovascular stories. If you don't want to miss a future episode of Neuro Innovation Talks or our other great Device Talks podcast, make sure you subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network. We'll have future podcast episodes sent directly to you. You can also follow us on YouTube. We'll have our audio and video portions or versions up there. So lots of great ways to keep informed and to gain great medtech insights. Finally, make sure you share this podcast episode on LinkedIn and other social media channels. And when you do, connect with me, Tom Salemi, Editorial Director at Device Talks, and our great Managing Editor, Kayleen Brown. We'd love to be part of your future medtech conversations. That's it, folks. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of the Neuro Innovation Talks podcast.